English Listening Comprehension Test, Spring 2010, Advanced Level. This test is in four parts. Part 4 has separate directions. In Parts 1, 2, and 3, you will answer the questions asked in the booklet by choosing the best alternative answer according to what you have heard. Mark each answer on the optical answer sheet. The test is about to begin. Now you will hear part one twice. First, listen to it straight through.
I'm very pleased to announce that we will have an interview with the world's most famous crash test dummy, Rusty Height. Our very own Jennifer Miller will interview Mr. Height.
How did you become a human crash test dummy?
By accident. Sorry, you asked for that. I was a policeman in California teaching accident investigation. I needed a way to do some hands-on experiments. The only way I could do it was to get in a car and crash it.
How do you categorize crashes?
We describe the potential severity of a crash not in terms of the speed at which the crash occurs, but of the change in speed. We call this the delta V. A change in speed of less than 10 miles per hour is a low-speed crash. Over 30 miles an hour gives a major delta V. In between is simply moderate.
What is the safest car to drive?
Bigger is better. When two cars collide, the one with the greater mass will experience a smaller delta V, so it should be safer for its occupants. Of course, the safest cars are also the ones with the most up-to-date safety features, but we don't really know which of these work.
How does your work make the roads safer?
What we do is teach people how to investigate car wrecks. If there are 50 crashes at a particular road junction and you don't know what causes them, what can you do to prevent the 51st? You first need to investigate those 50 wrecks and identify a common factor. Suppose we find that 45% of them were caused by people driving too fast southbound. What can we do to stop that? Traffic safety is about the three E's: engineering, enforcement, and education. Well then, we can re-engineer the road so that drivers cannot go so fast. For example, put in a stoplight. Or we can educate folks by putting up billboards telling them to reduce their speed. Or we could use enforcement. We could ask the police to give out tickets for speeding.
Now listen to the same discussion in three sections. Look at questions 1 and 2.
I'm very pleased to announce that we will have an interview with the world's most famous crash test dummy, Rusty Height. Our very own Jennifer Miller will interview Mr. Height.
How did you become a human crash test dummy?
By accident. Sorry, you asked for that. I was a policeman in California teaching accident investigation. I needed a way to do some hands-on experiments. The only way I could do it was to get in a car and crash it.
How do you categorize crashes?
We describe the potential severity of a crash not in terms of the speed at which the crash occurs, but of the change in speed. We call this the delta V. A change in speed of less than 10 miles per hour is a low-speed crash. Over 30 miles an hour gives a major delta V. In between is simply moderate.
Answer questions 1 and 2, then look at question 3.
What is the safest car to drive?
Bigger is better. When two cars collide, the one with the greater mass will experience a smaller delta V, so it should be safer for its occupants. Of course, the safest cars are also the ones with the most up-to-date safety features, but we don't really know which of these work.
Answer question 3, then look at questions 4 and 5.
How does your work make the roads safer?
What we do is teach people how to investigate car wrecks. If there are 50 crashes at a particular road junction and you don't know what causes them, what can you do to prevent the 51st? You first need to investigate those 50 wrecks and identify a common factor. Suppose we find that 45% of them were caused by people driving too fast southbound. What can we do to stop that? Traffic safety is about the three E's: engineering, enforcement, and education. Well then, we can re-engineer the road so that drivers cannot go so fast. For example, put in a stoplight. Or we can educate folks by putting up billboards telling them to reduce their speed. Or we could use enforcement. We could ask the police to give out tickets for speeding.
Answer questions 4 and 5. This is the second part of the test. You will hear this part twice. Listen to this part straight through.
We will now have an interview with the famous French novelist, Fred Vargas. She writes under a pseudonym, so the name sounds masculine. Not true. Another mystery is that she's an archaeologist, but best known for detective stories. And she's French, but her schooling might just explain her excellent English. Well, here's Lawrence Spinney interviewing Fred Vargas.
Can you approach a detective story in the same way as archaeology?
For years, I was asked if the two were linked. And first, I said no, because I write novels for fun. Archaeology is a serious business. But in both, there is a desire to find a way through a problem. At archaeology conferences, we don't even dance on the last evening. I've got 3 weeks of summer vacation, and I write a new novel every summer. And I write 15 hours a day for 21 days, and then I put the book away. Later I start to rewrite it, and I rework every single sentence. In history, the truth is rarely certain, but when you are inventing a detective story, you are the master. You know the truth.
The plague theme, the Black Death, is very much present in your first novel, to be translated into English as Have Mercy on Us All. Why is that, Miss Vargas?
I have spent 3 years sitting on a stool in the grey, dusty attics of the Pasteur Institute in Paris, reading all those medieval texts, and texts up to the 18th century. Plague is a heavy subject. It still exists, killing people every year. So I took notes for a novel as I was going along. I wrote Have Mercy on Us All to share the burden with my readers.
Why were you reading about plague?
I specialise in animal bones. That leads me into many areas. Animals are everywhere in human life. In religion, food, clothes and commerce. And bones are often preserved.
What's so interesting about rats?
It wasn't certain what date the black rat arrived in Europe from India. There was a belief that it had entered Europe with the returning Crusaders at the beginning of the 12th century. But no one had proved that for certain. I found it very puzzling. The commercial links between Europe and the Roman Empire's oriental ports were so dense and important. There was tremendous trade carried out for centuries. So I found it impossible to believe that the rat had not come over earlier. So we went digging for it, the rat, that is, in older layers.
So, what did you find?
You see, there had been a huge plague lasting from the 6th to the 8th centuries. Now, this pandemic exploded before archaeologists said the black rat had arrived. So people began to argue that the organism of transfer could not be the rat flea at all. It had to be the human flea. So I created a map, a synthesis of all the archaeological digs where the black rat had been found. It arrived on islands in the Mediterranean in the 1st century, then spread to the continent. In the temperate climate of Europe, it's obliged to stay with man. It cannot live freely on its own, like in India. A man arrives in a place bringing infected rat fleas. He may infect a few people around him, and the fleas move off him into the local rat population. That's where they want to be. And suddenly, all the rats die. The fleas are forced to accept the next best thing, a human. That's disaster. So, there are a few human deaths, then silence, then plague. I went looking for this silence and found at least 100 examples. People would often accuse the government of a cover-up.
Miss Vargas, how does all this relate to your fiction, to detective stories, and to police fiction?
There is something deeply human here. In Greek stories, you have the hero who travels to fight the monster, half human and half animal. It's a representation of evil, and particularly of the dangers lying within humanity. And around it is a sort of labyrinth, so it's very difficult to reach the final battle. And in medieval legends, there's exactly the same construction with the symbolic dangers of dragons and a forest, which is just like a labyrinth. And the detective story has the same structure. The murderer is a symbolic representation of the dangers of life and the savage part within man. And detective stories have a job to help people live with their fears. I really think it's necessary for man to represent the dangers, identify them, and conquer them every day.
Let me just say, Fred Vargas, thank you for this most enlightening interview.
Now listen to the same interview in 5 sections. Look at questions 6 and 7.
We will now have an interview with the famous French novelist, Fred Vargas. She writes under a pseudonym, so the name sounds masculine. Not true. Another mystery is that she's an archaeologist, but best known for detective stories. And she's French, but her schooling might just explain her excellent English. Well, here's Lawrence Spinney interviewing Fred Vargas.
Can you approach a detective story in the same way as archaeology?
For years, I was asked if the two were linked. And first, I said no, because I write novels for fun. Archaeology is a serious business. But in both, there is a desire to find a way through a problem. At archaeology conferences, we don't even dance on the last evening. I've got 3 weeks of summer vacation, and I write a new novel every summer. And I write 15 hours a day for 21 days, and then I put the book away. Later I start to rewrite it, and I rework every single sentence. In history, the truth is rarely certain, but when you are inventing a detective story, you are the master. You know the truth.
Answer questions 6 and 7, then look at questions 8 and 9.
The plague theme, the Black Death, is very much present in your first novel, to be translated into English as Have Mercy on Us All. Why is that, Miss Vargas?
I have spent 3 years sitting on a stool in the grey, dusty attics of the Pasteur Institute in Paris, reading all those medieval texts, and texts up to the 18th century. Plague is a heavy subject. It still exists, killing people every year. So I took notes for a novel as I was going along. I wrote Have Mercy on Us All to share the burden with my readers.
Why were you reading about plague?
I specialise in animal bones. That leads me into many areas. Animals are everywhere in human life, in religion, food, clothes, and commerce. And bones are often preserved.
Answer questions 8 and 9. Look at questions 10 and 11.
What's so interesting about rats?
It wasn't certain what date the black rat arrived in Europe from India. There was a belief that it had entered Europe with the returning crusaders at the beginning of the 12th century. But no one had proved that for certain. I found it very puzzling. The commercial links between Europe and the Roman Empire's Oriental ports were so dense and important. There was tremendous trade carried out for centuries. So I found it impossible to believe that the rat had not come over earlier. So we went digging for it. The rat, that is, in older layers.
Answer questions 10 and 11, then look at questions 12 and 13.
So, what did you find?
You see, there had been a huge plague lasting from the 6th to the 8th centuries. Now, this pandemic exploded before archaeologists said the black rat had arrived. So people began to argue that the organism of transfer could not be the rat flea at all. It had to be the human flea. So, I created a map. A synthesis of all the archaeological digs where the black rat had been found. It arrived on islands in the Mediterranean in the 1st century, then spread to the continent. In the temperate climate of Europe, it's obliged to stay with man. It cannot live freely on its own, like in India. A man arrives in a place bringing infected rat fleas. He may infect a few people around him, and the fleas move off him into the local rat population. That's where they want to be. And suddenly, all the rats die. The fleas are forced to accept the next best thing, a human. That's disaster. So, there are a few human deaths, then silence, then plague. I went looking for this silence and found at least 100 examples. People would often accuse the government of a cover-up.
Answer questions 12 and 13. Look at questions 14 and 15.
Miss Vargas, how does all this relate to your fiction, to detective stories, to police fiction?
There is something deeply human here. In Greek stories, you have the hero who travels to fight the monster, half human and half animal. It's a representation of evil, and particularly of the dangers lying within humanity. And around it is a sort of labyrinth, so it's very difficult to reach the final battle. And in medieval legends, there's exactly the same construction with the symbolic dangers of dragons and a forest, which is just like a labyrinth. And the detective story has the same structure. The murderer is a symbolic representation of the dangers of life and the savage part within man. And detective stories have a job to help people live with their fears. I really think it's necessary for man to represent the dangers, identify them, and conquer them every day.
Let me just say, Fred Vargas, thank you for this most enlightening interview.
Answer questions 14 and 15. This is the third part of the test. In this part, you will hear 10 short dialogues. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 16.
Do you know what it says here in the paper?
No, what does it say?
There's a new piece of research that when children learn the name of a color, it changes the part of the brain that handles color perception.
What do you mean?
Infants perceive color in the right hemisphere of the brain. When they learn the name of the color, then that changes. The name is in the left hemisphere.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing happens when infants learn the names for a dog and cat and so on.
Answer question 16, then look at question 17.
Do you remember the children's story about the Pied Piper of Hamelin?
Yes, the German fellow who drove the rats from the village of Hamelin. I think it was centuries ago.
Yes, centuries ago. But now there has been an explosion in the town's rodent population. That's due to a rubbish dump right in town.
Well, maybe they need to bring the piper back. But didn't he also pipe the children out of the town as well as the rats?
Yes, after the townspeople refused to pay him for his work.
Answer question 17. Look at question 18.
Meh. Meh.
What did you say?
Meh.
And what's that supposed to mean?
Well, meh is a new word. It's used to indicate indifference or boredom, to say that something's mediocre.
Well then, meh.
I know, meh. It's that kind of day. But the word meh has jumped over from the Simpsons animation series to the Collins English Dictionary. It's now as much British as American.
Answer question 18. Then look at question 19.
There was a bit of a scandal over in Christchurch yesterday.
Scandal?
Well, maybe that's too harsh a word. But there was a teenage beauty queen competition there in Christchurch. One 17-year-old girl won. But a few minutes later, her beauty title and crown were taken away.
Oh, why was that?
She had listed her address wrong. She had given her sister's address. Not only did she herself not live in Christchurch, but her sister lived a full mile out of the area as well.
Oh, poor thing. They should really check on that sort of detail before they start a competition like that.
I'll say.
Answer question 19. Look at question 20.
There was a burglary in Omaha yesterday.
Good heavens, seems like there's one every day.
And the thieves had searched high and low, apparently for something of value to steal.
And they took...
Well, they had to settle for a tuna sandwich. The owner noticed the break-in when she came home and found a window broken.
Sounds like all she's out for is a window, then.
Yeah, that's all.
Answer question 20, then look at question 21.
Did you read the piece about kangaroos?
Yes, I did. Interesting. Humans and kangaroos are close cousins on the evolutionary tree. We shared a common ancestor 150 million years ago.
That's right. Australian researchers are mapping the genetic code of kangaroos.
And so we now know a lot more about what humans were like 150 million years ago.
Yeah, there are huge chunks of the human genome sitting right there in the kangaroo genome. The researchers thought the combinations of the genes would be scrambled, but they're not.
I know, it's quite fascinating.
Answer question 21. Look at question 22.
You know how expensive Parmesan cheese is?
Do I ever? I'd love to be able to buy it more often.
Well, the Italian Ministry of Agriculture is buying 3,000 tons of Parmesan. Parmigiano Reggiano.
What for?
They're going to donate it to the needy. You see, not enough of the cheese is being consumed, so the price has been falling.
And so the government will help out. How cute! And the Italian poor can eat cheese.
Well, it is very, very good cheese. You'll have to admit that.
Of course it is.
Answer question 22, then look at question 23.
There is a 3-mile-long cloud of garlic hanging over Farnborough.
Oh, what? Where?
A cloud of garlic odour. It's causing problems in Farnborough. The odour has escaped from a cracker factory. They were producing a new garlic and rosemary-flavoured crisp bread. It's so bad you can smell it in the next town.
How long has it been there?
Well, for a week now. It's so strong that people have to stay inside. They have even been advised to stick towels under their doors, just to keep the odour out.
Well, I like garlic.
But this odour is terribly intense. No one can stand it.
Answer question 23. Look at question 24.
Did you hear about the bubble wrap competition?
No, not at all. You mean bubble wrap, the plastic stuff with bubbles in it, the stuff you use for packing things you don't want to break in the mail?
Yeah, bubble wrap. Well, there's an inventors competition every year for bubble wrap. People make everything out of it. Hats, shelters for the homeless, floor lamps, everything. And Jose Lopez is one of the winners. He's 11 years old.
What did he invent?
Well, his family has two parrots that they kept outside last winter in Tucson, Arizona. It does get down to freezing there. He built a wooden birdhouse that had insulation made of bubble wrap.
I'd say that's pretty down to earth. Good idea.
And he said he just wants to keep their eggs warm. Isn't that sweet?
Answer question 24, then look at question 25.
Women are better at do-it-yourself furniture than men.
Ah, come on now.
The head of IKEA in Germany says that's true. Women read the directions. Men just start doing it. A woman first sorts the parts in an orderly way. Men throw them in a pile and then something goes missing.
You may have a point there. And I'll remember that the next time I need to put together some flat box furniture.
Oh, thanks.
Answer question 25. This is the fourth part of the test. It is a discussion among three people. You will hear this twice. First, listen to this straight through.
I would like to extend a warm welcome to Susan Short and Andrew Jarvis, who are here to discuss barbecue with me. It's not good unless it's barbecue.
No, it isn't.
Well, Susan, your research into barbecue has taken you around the country.
Yes, it has. Barbecue is very localized, so I get all my most important research info from town librarians. Barbecue is different not only from state to state, but say from one town to another. Two towns 15 miles apart in North Carolina have very different barbecue. That's not to mention the changes you'll find from Texas to Tennessee.
Now, Andrew, you're British. Now, we don't expect anything to come out of England that has to do with barbecue.
You're absolutely right. The food served up as barbecue in England over the years is pretty sorry grub. They boil their ribs and then smear some disgusting sauce over it. I shudder at the very thought. After all, I'm a classically trained chef.
But nevertheless, you've opened up a chain of barbecue restaurants in London, Bodine's. Are they truly different?
Yes, and in two ways. We offer real barbecue, and our restaurants are wildly successful.
Getting back to you, Susan, where did this barbecue thing come from?
From the southern U.S., from the Carolinas, Tennessee, Georgia, on over to Texas. And it created early business opportunities for entrepreneurial African Americans, for those recently released from slavehood. After the American Civil War, Kansas City became one of the centers for barbecue. There were really cheap meats there and really nice wood, with hickory forests nearby. Those are the basic facts.
Now that you've mentioned it, I'll have to talk about Kansas City. I'd earlier had successful restaurants in London organized around a Belgian theme. But I sold them and was looking for something that London was missing. It was missing Kansas City. It's the spiritual home of pit smoking. You get your meat, you treat it, rub it down with sauce, and then you slow smoke it in a special pit oven with wood chips, slow heat. The secret is to slow smoke it in low heat for 12 to 16 hours. It's delicious. You might presume it's dry after being in the oven so long. No way. Just seals the flavour and juices in. Just take me to Gates or Bryant's restaurants in Kansas City.
But the heart and core of the barbecue tradition is family life. It's fathers and uncles and grandfathers barbecuing in the backyard, piling your plate high not only with good food, but with love and care. You help. You carry your plate. You serve the family women. You move yard furniture around. You clean up afterwards. But it's all about building families and passing on the tradition.
Now listen to the same discussion in 5 sections. After each section, you will have time to answer. Then you will go on to the next section. You will write in Finnish or Swedish. You must write your answers on the special answer sheet. Read question A. Question A, listen to this and then answer the question.
I would like to extend a warm welcome to Susan Short and Andrew Jarvis, who are here to discuss barbecue with me. It's not good unless it's barbecue.
No, it isn't.
Well, Susan, your research into barbecue has taken you around the country.
Yes, it has. Barbecue is very localized, so I get all my most important research info from town librarians. Barbecue is different not only from state to state, but say from one town to another. Two towns 15 miles apart in North Carolina have very different barbecue. That's not to mention the changes you'll find from Texas to Tennessee.
Read question B. Question B, listen to this and then answer the question.
Now, Andrew, you're British. Now, we don't expect anything to come out of England that has to do with barbecue.
You're absolutely right. The food served up as barbecue in England over the years is pretty sorry grub. They boil their ribs and then smear some disgusting sauce over it. I shudder at the very thought. After all, I'm a classically trained chef.
But nevertheless, you've opened up a chain of barbecue restaurants in London, Bodine's. Are they truly different?
Yes, and in two ways. We offer real barbecue, and our restaurants are wildly successful.
Read question C. Question C, listen to this and then answer the question.
Getting back to you, Susan, where did this barbecue thing come from?
From the southern U.S., from the Carolinas, Tennessee, Georgia, on over to Texas. And it created early business opportunities for entrepreneurial African Americans, for those recently released from slavehood. After the American Civil War, Kansas City became one of the centers for barbecue. There were really cheap meats there and really nice wood, with hickory forests nearby. Those are the basic facts.
Read question D. Question D. Listen to this and then answer the question.
Now that you've mentioned it, I'll have to talk about Kansas City. I'd earlier had successful restaurants in London organized around a Belgian theme. But I sold them and was looking for something that London was missing. It was missing Kansas City. It's the spiritual home of pit smoking. You get your meat, you treat it, rub it down with sauce, and then you slow smoke it in a special pit oven with wood chips, slow heat. The secret is to slow smoke it in low heat for 12 to 16 hours. It's delicious. You might presume it's dry after being in the oven so long. No way. Just seals the flavour and juices in. Just take me to Gates or Bryant's restaurants in Kansas City.
Read question E. Question E. Listen to this and then answer the question.
But the heart and core of the barbecue tradition is family life. It's fathers and uncles and grandfathers barbecuing in the backyard, piling your plate high not only with good food, but with love and care. You help. You carry your plate. You serve the family women. You move yard furniture around. You clean up afterwards. But it's all about building families and passing on the tradition.
This is the end of the test. You will now have 8 minutes in which to blacken with a pencil the ovals indicating your answers and to check the written answers. Remember to make sure you have written the following information on your answer sheet: your name and number, and the name and number of your school. In addition, make sure that the information needed for the exam has been carefully marked in. Thank you.